We want to advise our listeners that this episode contains brief, strong language. Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show is episode number 33, featuring my conversation with Dr. Daniel Ellsberg, an ardent anti-war activist and whistleblower who is best known for releasing the Pentagon Papers in 1971. Dan and I talk about seeking the truth, holding our governments accountable, and how to preserve democracy in the present day. I hope our discussion leaves you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. Even though I'm an English teacher, my love for history runs deep. I strongly believe that if we don't learn from the past, we are doomed to repeat it. That's why I'm so honored to share today's guest with you, an iconic figure of history who continues to use his knowledge to spread truth and preserve democracy today. Many of you are familiar with the controversial cases of modern-day whistleblowers, such as Chelsea Manning, whose revelations were published by WikiLeaks and other major newspapers, and Edward Snowden. We hope this riveting examination of a past whistleblower helps you put today's headlines in historical perspective. Daniel Ellsberg was a key figure at the RAND Corporation in the 1960s, during which time he also served as a consultant to the White House and the Pentagon. After going to Vietnam as a Foreign Service officer, Dan returned to the RAND Corporation and worked as part of the team on the top-secret Pentagon Papers. He was one of the few people who had access to the entire study, which detailed how the U.S. entered an escalating stalemate in Vietnam that had continued under four presidential administrations. The report contained evidence that President Lyndon B. Johnson, along with his Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, had lied, not only to the American public, but to Congress itself, about the progress being made in Vietnam. Throughout the course of this war, roughly 55,000 American soldiers were killed, and millions of people in Indochina lost their lives. After reading this report in its entirety, Dan Ellsberg came to believe that essentially all of those deaths were unjustified because it wasn't a just war. Even though he assumed he would go to prison for the rest of his life for releasing the Pentagon Papers, Daniel Ellsberg chose to expose those patterns of corruption and give the public what they needed most, the truth. Dan's story was most recently portrayed in the Oscar-nominated film, The Post, directed by Steven Spielberg. Today, national security is back in the headlines with rumors of another war. Throughout our conversation for this episode, you'll hear Dan reference a recent article in The New Yorker called On the Warpath by Dexter Filkins. Dan analyzes the article's message, incensed by what seems to be the same hawkish attitudes about war that he witnessed in the 1960s and 70s. Specifically, the article examines John Bolton, the current national security advisor to the president, and the potential prospects of inciting war with Iran. As Dan offers us nothing less than a masterclass in political analysis and civic duty, I invite you to consider how you can defend democracy by speaking out against injustice at any level and keeping our elected officials accountable for their actions. I have the privilege of being with Dan Ellsberg at his home, tucked above the green hills of Berkeley, California. Before we sat down in his living room to record, he took our team on a tour of his basement. An immense archive of documents, personal notes, and books that are organized by topic and timeline. As Dan showed me the faded front page of the June 13, 1971 issue of the New York Times, I truly realized that I'm in the presence of an icon and a hero. Now at 88 years old, Dan has as many years as the number of times he's been arrested for nonviolent civil disobedience. Dan, it is truly an honor to sit knee to knee with you today. To understand our present, we have to understand our past. And so I'm envisioning a teacher who is a voracious student of history and politics, wanting her students to read newspapers today, watch the news today, to understand what's happening in current America by holding a mirror to the past. And you are this historical figure that bridges the gap between the past and the present. Tell us about those papers and why those papers changed the trajectory of your life.
Well, I knew from my time in Vietnam, which is 65 to 67, the fact that the war was at best stalemated and should not continue, because to continue it was killing people and having Americans killed, so no good effect at all, and couldn't be justified, and that should be ended. So I had that feeling, as did most people in Vietnam who went over there. 3 million, mostly military, went there in the course of the war, and I think virtually all of them felt, given what we're doing, this war isn't going to succeed. We're not succeeding. Nothing is happening of any use. We're taking a hill one day and then off it, and the Viet Cong have it the next day, and that was pretty obvious. The question was, what do you do about that? That was my sense from early 66 on, but I kept on the thought that if I tell the truth to these people, maybe that will help change the policy. One thing I learned from reading the Pentagon Papers, which was a 47-volume, 7,000-page study, every page top secret sensitive, because the existence of the study was a secret from the president. It was done under McNamara, and they weren't so worried about the president's reaction as his national security assistant, the John Bolton of his day, Walt Rostow, later Henry Kissinger. And that Rostow was so committed that this is doable, this is viable, we can keep doing it, you know, and so forth. And it was sensitive, meaning that's not a classification. It means be careful who you show this to, even if they have a top secret clearance, if their policy views are different, if they might leak it, if they might oppose it, you know, and so on. We didn't want Rostow to see this study because it told the truth about Vietnam. Well, the truth that came through very clearly at first was simply to confirm what I already knew, that this thing had been stalemated essentially every year of the war at best, and we would have lost it had we not escalated. So it was an escalating stalemate. So that didn't surprise me. It surprised other people that we had known that. But what I read in the first volumes of it were, going back to 1945 to 54, what was, we always regarded it in the Pentagon and in Vietnam, as the French-Vietnamese War. I was told by a Vietnamese friend of mine, Tran Ngoc Chau, that every peasant in Vietnam understood that as a French-American war, which no American, almost no American would have appreciated. Well, why did they think that? Well, because we were paying 80% of the cost of the war. And I said, how could illiterate peasants know that when we back in the States never heard this? We didn't know that at all. He said, well, we told them. He then was a political officer for the Viet Minh, fighting French occupation. So as a political cadre, he said, we told the peasants, you know, we're fighting Americans and French. I hadn't understood that. So I'd heard it from anti-war people, but I didn't trust their notion of history. And here I was reading it in top secret reports that said exactly what the anti-war people had said, essentially. What I saw was that the war had been, from an American point of view, illegitimate and unjust war from the beginning. Not just that it had come to be too costly and too hopeless and too stalemated, but that it had been an unjust war from the very beginning, because we were supporting a French effort to recapture a colony that had declared its independence. Now, strictly speaking, that was not clearly illegal under the UN, because the UN Charter had allowed for continued colonial occupations. But from an American point of view, to be clearly supporting by fire and sword a colonial reconquest was illegitimate. We thought of ourselves as having been the first independence struggle. Another way to say that would be the first national liberation movement, partly a guerrilla war, by the way. Remember, using the tactics of the Indians, so forth, which the British regarded as savagery on our part. So the idea that we had been part of this war from the beginning meant to me that everyone killed in Vietnam, not just the civilians, but the soldiers we were killing, the guerrillas we were killing, and the Vietnamese were dying on our side, and the Americans. None of those deaths were justified, actually. They shouldn't have happened. And what would have happened had we not intervened at all? Well, almost surely, the communist-led Viet Cong, or Democratic Republic of Vietnam, they call themselves, would have prevailed in an election, as we always said. Not because everyone agreed with them, but because people didn't want the war, and they had the unique cachet of having expelled the foreign invaders, the French and Americans. And so that gave them a prestige that nobody else had, as we knew very well in Vietnam, it turned out. So, as I've been saying, that meant to me that all the deaths in the war were unjustified homicide. That, to me, spelled murder. Strictly speaking, after Nuremberg, killing in a war, let's say, of adversarial soldiers is not held as murder, even if the war is unjust. Let's say by German soldiers. It's the generals and the admirals and the officials that were held responsible under that. And so the killing at the low level, you don't prosecute soldiers for doing that. You do, in principle and occasionally in practice, prosecute them for war crimes, for killing civilians deliberately, which does happen at a great amount, but which is criminal. Okay, to me it was all criminal as a layman here. It was murder and I shouldn't be part of it anymore, but it went beyond that. To stop murder, it wasn't enough for me simply to absent myself from it, to resign, let's say, and quit out, but to expose it and to oppose it and do whatever I could. And the example at that very time that I happened to see was of people who in this country were following the example of Gandhi and Martin Luther King, who was a student of Gandhian thought, and they were opposing the draft nonviolently, going to prison for refusing to cooperate with the draft, when they could have been conscientious objectors, or gone to Canada or Sweden, or done what George W. Bush did, join the National Guard. Well, they weren't going to do that, of course. These were essentially pacifist people. They certainly could have gotten medical deferments, this and that, but they chose instead to go to prison, to make the strongest possible statement that this was a wrong war, that they couldn't participate, and no one else should be participating in it. It was wrong and worth going to prison to resist. I realized that what these people were doing was the right thing for them to be doing. They were correct about the policy. I knew it. I saw the policy even more aggressively than they did because they didn't know the war was going to get larger in 69. I did from my early work for Nixon and Kissinger at the beginning of 69 and later. So I knew it was going to go on and get larger. They didn't even know that, but they were still going to prison to resist it. And would they be called dangerous? Well, no, these people, you know, just going to prison, who knows, you know, only their family, basically. 5,000 young men went to prison. 50,000 were in legal proceedings, and hundreds of thousands didn't cooperate but weren't called into proceedings on it. So it was very large. Probably no other country had that phenomenon in any war. Were they dangerous to the policy? Well, they changed my life. And I was seen as somebody who had access to these high-level documents showing that the war had been unjustified and unjust and was knowingly pursued with no hope of ending it by victory or any other way, just going on and, for each president, avoiding being called a loser, avoiding losing a war while he was in office and passing it on to the next one. And that was their victory, which they succeeded each time in doing. But to me, that wasn't a good reason for pursuing war, and it was nothing other than mass murder. I was in a position to put out that four presidents preceding Nixon, who was then in office, had acted in this way. And I thought that might have a chance of persuading people that Nixon was doing the same, which he was, lying, threatening, preparing, planning to expand the war, pursuing aims that were infeasible, but that would prolong the war indefinitely. I didn't have documents. Nixon feared I did, with good reason. People had left his administration and resigned over his invasion of Cambodia, but they didn't make a press conference. They did it silently. They hoped the press would come to them and then they wouldn't talk out. They said they would, but no press came to them when they resigned. So they didn't. And as one of them, Roger Morris, who worked under Kissinger, said to me later, we should have thrown open the safes and screamed bloody murder, because that's exactly what it was. So I opened the safe and screamed bloody murder. But the trouble was, it was murder by four previous presidents that I could prove. I was dangerous only because Nixon, as I say, had reason to believe that Roger Morris, who was a friend of mine, could have given me the documents that he should have done. Morris said later, "It is the greatest shame and regret of my life that we did not put out documents showing that he was making these nuclear threats and that the war was going to go on." He didn't do it. But he could have. And Nixon knew he could have. And Nixon feared that I had those documents.
Having seen the boxes and filing cabinets of your documents, what was that like for you to Xerox those documents and make a determination that you were going to go to first the New York Times and then the Post? What was that like for you to realize I'm going to take all of these documents and share them with the public?
Well, it meant for me that I would go to prison for life. I assumed that.
115 years.
I didn't know the charges before I got them, but the 115 years I was charged with would have been most of my life. Even with good behavior, 35 years. I would have gotten out recently if I'd had good behavior, unless they really gave me a hard time, as they did Chelsea Manning, then Bradley. She had a hard time. She is now in prison for refusing to go to a grand jury that is investigating Julian Assange, to whom she gave her documents. She won't be part of the grand jury because it's a secret process. You can't have your lawyer in there with you. You cannot have a transcript of the proceedings. So having gone in, other people in a movement will fear that you've exposed them or that you've turned evidence against them. You can't prove otherwise. So there are a number of people who oppose this process. And my co-defendant, Tony Russo, had done the same thing. He was brought into the grand jury after I'd been arraigned, charged. And he wouldn't testify unless he got a transcript that would show what he said. So they put him in jail, just like Chelsea now is in jail as we speak, for refusing. And he was in jail. And eventually they decided to charge him along with me. So he was charged with 3 counts. I was charged with 12. So you say, what was it like? Well, my thought was, in Vietnam, when I believed in the war, which was at the beginning, later I didn't believe in it, but I thought that if I took part in, observed people in combat, saw what was actually happening, that I was doing a good job, that this was something good to do, that it might reduce the violence. Actually, the Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge had authorized me to go down and take part in this operation in the South, in Long Island, because he didn't think U.S. troops should be put in the South, which was densely populated, and that the air power that would accompany them would destroy a lot of civilians. He wanted to stop that. So he and his Deputy Ambassador William Porter, for whom I worked, encouraged me to go down there. And I used my Marine training as a former company commander to walk with the troops. And I was saying to somebody just yesterday, who called me up, who had known my friend John Paul Van, and mentioned that I was 36 at that time. And he said, "Oh, you were pretty old," because he was there at that time. He was 20. And I said, "Well, actually, I was, to be walking in the field, actually walking point a good deal, because to see that war, which is a guerrilla war, you really had to be up front. People in the back didn't see too much. There was the people in front who got shot at and could see who they were fighting occasionally." So I'd walked point, and probably I was the only 36-year-old person who had done that, because if I'd stayed in the military, which I considered at one point, I would have been a major or lieutenant colonel by that time, well behind the lines in Vietnam. I wouldn't have been seeing what was happening up at the front. Now, as I say, the point here was I stayed in because, in theory, I wanted to stop that bombing, stop the troops from going in, stop civilians from being killed. That's 1967. Fast forward to 1972. I'm on trial since 71. The Kissinger tapes and Nixon tapes, I've heard, where there was a new offensive going on, and Nixon wants to go all out against them. And again, here, let's might as well quote it exactly. April 25th, 1972. I am on trial at this point. And I had just put out more documents. It was 7,000 pages of the Pentagon Papers, and then about 1,000 other documents that I had supporting the Pentagon Papers. And then about 500 pages of a study called NISM 1, National Security Study Memorandum 1. Anyway, this is on the day that the Washington Post first published accounts of NISM 1, which I had put out. Yeah, here it is.
I want our listeners to know that this is being read directly from the national bestseller Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers by the esteemed Dan Ellsberg.
This is Nixon on the tape. We've got to stop thinking in terms of a three-day strike on Haiphong. We've got to be thinking of an all-out bombing attack, which will continue to now by all-out bombing attack. I'm thinking about things that go far beyond. I'm thinking of the dikes. I'm thinking of the railroad. I'm thinking of the docks. Kissinger, I agree with you. We've got to use massive force. Now, when you say dikes, by the way, see, that's a war crime, of course, against civilians. 2 hours later, Haldeman and Ron Ziegler joined Kissinger and Nixon. Ziegler was the press secretary. President, how many did we kill in Laos? Ziegler, maybe 10,000, 15? Kissinger, in the Laotian thing, we killed about 10, 15. President, see, the attack in the north we have in mind, power plants, whatever's left, POL patrolling in the docks, and I think we ought to take the dikes out now. Will that drown people? About 200,000 people. No, no, no. I'd rather use the nuclear bomb. Have you got that, Henry? That, I think, would be just too much. The nuclear bomb, does that bother you? I just want you to think big, Henry, for Christ's sakes. That's April 25th. On May 3rd, a week later, I have been telling they're going to mine Haiphong. I knew that from early study I'd done with Nixon. And that's what they didn't want out. See? So they brought a dozen people up from Miami with orders to incapacitate me totally at a rally on the steps of the Capitol. That didn't happen because they were given a false cover story, plausible denial here, but they gave them a cover story that I was going to interfere with Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover's of the FBI, funeral. He had died the day before, and he was sitting in state in the Capitol on the other side. So when they realized that our rally was on the other side from Hoover's body, which they thought they were protecting from mad Dr. Ellsberg and his people, and that the crowd was not Hoover mourners, what they thought was they were being set up to be caught, as one of them said later, like Oswald. So this is another one, by the way, where Kissinger gets more credit. A week later, he says he wants to bring them to their knees. We've got to give back our prisoners. America is not defeated. We must not lose in Vietnam. So we must draw the sword. So the blockade is on. And I must say that I like it. And I want this clearly understood. The surgical operation theory is all right, but I want that place bombed to smithereens. If we draw the sword, we're going to bomb those bastards all over the place. Let it fly, let it fly. Later, Kissinger relays the order, kill everything that moves.
Kill everything that moves.
Terse uses that as the title of his book. It's a quote. Then on May 4th, discussing his decision to start the bombing, he's now going to bomb with B-52s. Hanoi had never been bombed. North Vietnam had not been bombed with B-52s. So this is the first with B-52s, and that's what I'd been trying to avoid. So Nixon is showing, and we have the tape of this, thumping his desk as he pointed to a map on the desk. He says, Vietnam, here's those little cocksuckers right in there. Here they are. Here's the United States. Here's Western Europe, that cocky little place that's caused so much devastation. Here's the Soviet Union. Here's the Mideast. Here's the silly Africans. And the not quite so silly Latin Americans. Here we are. They're taking on the U.S. Now, God damn it, we're going to do it. We're going to cream them. This is not in anger or anything. This old business that I'm petulant, that's all bullshit. I should have done it long ago. I just didn't follow my instincts. I'll see that the U.S. does not lose. I'm putting it quite bluntly. I'll be quite precise. South Vietnam may lose, but the United States cannot lose, which means basically I've made the decision, whatever happens to South Vietnam, we are going to cream North Vietnam. For once, we've got to use the maximum power of this country against this shit-ass little country to win the war. We can't use the word win, but others can. And so later that day, Nixon says to Kissinger, the only place where you and I disagree is with regard to the bombing. You're so goddamn concerned about the civilians, and I don't give a damn. I don't care. Kissinger, I'm concerned about the civilians because I don't want the world to be mobilized against you as a butcher.
In the modern day context, I've heard that you believe that the Mueller report, 448 pages worth, should be leaked.
In other words, I think that the Congress is doing the right thing now. They have the right to that report. They should insist. They should use their full power. They should subpoena. They should do everything. I don't think anyone, if I were inside, should short-circuit that process and say, Congress doesn't matter. You know, I'm just putting it out. No, Congress should assert their authority for once to get it. Only if they absolutely couldn't get it after going through this process. And I would say, of course, it should be leaked. A report that I certainly would have leaked if I'd had the capability, and I urged people who did have that capability to do it, senators, was the 6,000-page torture report. There's never been a report like that in the history of the world, revealing every detail of all the tortures we did, and showing, by the way, that none of them achieved any useful information, aside from being illegal domestically and internationally and everything else, but absolutely purposeless. That report has not been held. So it does apply so much to this story, which is in this week's New Yorker, you realize, on the warpath. Can John Bolton sell an isolationist president on military force? By Dexter Filkins. And the theme of this is that at every stage, Bolton is pressing for war. And the president is holding back on the whole. And they keep asking, well, how can you be in an administration, you know, that is not going your way here? You want war and you're not getting war. And he keeps asking, said, well, some you win and some you lose. You know, he doesn't get his way all the time, but he's the pressure there to give it. Now, some interesting quotes. Bolton has believed for decades that there are only two choices, to live with the North Korea with nuclear weapons or military force. He's believed for decades he's the only two forces. Stridently advocated war under George W. Bush. Secretary of State Powell, former chief of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, was so concerned that he brought Bolton into a private meeting on the consequences of military strikes. I gave him a, this is Wilkerson, who I know now, who is a whistleblower after the war, and says, after retiring, and said, having been Powell's chief of staff for a long time, when he was military and then in civilian, Wilkerson is a colonel, he said he had a letter of resignation in his desk in the lead up to the Iraq war. And every morning he says, I took that letter out of my desk and looked at it. And then I put it back in because, you know, he wanted to be loyal to his boss, Powell. He didn't want to leave him there alone. And so he regrets that very much, that he didn't. He could have prevented the war if he'd done what I did with current documents, just as McNamara could have ended it, various other people. Wilkerson could have prevented the war. He says that. I mean, he acknowledges that. He's very good. Anyway, while he was in, he said, I gave him a 10-minute brief on what a war with North Korea would be like. 100,000 casualties in the first 30 days, many of them Americans. The Japanese would die. The Chinese would die. The fact that Seoul, our ally, one of the most modern and forward-looking cities in the world, would probably be reduced to the Dark Ages. I told him, that's Passchendaele, John, that's Ypres. That's not actually right. Passchendaele was a bloody battle in the First World War, as was Ypres, but it was all soldiers, it wasn't civilians. This is more like Dresden, Hiroshima, Tokyo. He said that Bolton was unmoved. John looked at me, says Wilkerson, and said, are you done? Clearly, you do war. I don't do war, I do policy. Meaning, we ought to do it. Go to war, you figure out how to do it. The casualties, and he's still saying, so in North Korea, it's still viable. They're not counting the casualties at all. The situation is, in other words, where we have been over and over, as the Pentagon Papers showed. As Rumsfeld and Haldeman said, you can't trust the judgment of the president, and people will do what he wants, even though they know it's wrong. That's the lesson. But the lesson can be that students can be told, and teachers can be told, and everybody, you can withdraw your cooperation. You can get in the way of this machine. You can do what you can to tell the truth, and it may help. Out of my 88 arrests, I would say most of them you couldn't see any effect at all, but it can help. That's all you can do, and it's worth it. When a war's worth of lives is at stake, yes, it is worth considering and possibly doing something that will lose you your career, your access, your clearance, even hurt your family, definitely, kids going to college, be in jail forever. It can be worth that to prevent a war, to prevent the Constitution being shredded, as Ed Snowden tried to prevent with his revelation about surveillance, Chelsea Manning with the war crimes and torture in Iraq and Afghanistan. Yes, they did what they should have done, and it can have an effect, and that's worth it.
My students met Meep Geese, who saved Anne Frank. And when they asked her if she thought she was a hero, she said, "I simply did what I had to do because it was the right thing to do." And I feel those sentiments are true with you, that you simply did what you had to do because it was the right thing to do. You took a calculated risk.
Yeah. But not because I couldn't live with myself if I didn't do it, or I didn't think of any alternatives or not. It's not, in a way, as easy as that. If that's the way it were, it would be easy. I have no other choice. I have to do this. I have to tell the truth. I'd go along with untruths for a decade. You can't be in the government if you can't stand living with people who lie to the public, or without lying to your public yourself. You can't be in the government. When you consider what to say to the public about what we're doing in the government, you can always do better than the truth. You can always tailor it to the audience a little better, make it better, and you can avoid accountability for that because it's secret. Now, this is in 66. I was sitting in the plane coming back with McNamara.
Coming back from Vietnam.
From Vietnam, because I had been there to brief Katzenbach, who was the new Undersecretary of State, and I was to accompany him in Vietnam and tell him what was going on and so forth. I'm sitting in the plane, and McNamara had read all my reports earlier. The man he was sitting with was Bob Comer from the White House. So now he's talking to Comer, who is still in charge of Vietnam for the White House, and McNamara says to me, "Dan, we're having an argument here. Bob Comer says the situation is much better than it was last year, and I'm saying it's even worse. You're the one who knows," he said.
"You're the one
what
that
knows.
What
do you knows. Say, Dan? What do you say?" I said, "Well, Mr. Secretary, I would say that I'm most struck by how much the same it is as last year." And McNamara says, "There, you see, that's my point. We put in another 100,000 troops, and it's just the same. That means the underlying situation is actually worse." And at this moment, the pilot says, "Gentlemen, take your seats. We're coming into Andrews for landing." So they come down very fast, and within minutes, we're going down the passenger stairs, and McNamara is striding out. I'm right behind him. McNamara is striding out to a huge circle of cameras and lights. It was a press conference, but the lights were on because it was a misty day, and he comes out and says, minutes after he said to me, "It's actually worse," he says, "Gentlemen, I've just come back from Vietnam, and we're making progress there by every dimension, that we can count. I'm very reassured by what's going on." And I remember sending a tape as we communicated to my later wife, Patricia, saying this story and saying, "I hope I'm never in a job where I have to lie like this." So the realities are secret. The secrecy system gives you the choice. And on one hand, people act as if they have no choice but to keep their jobs or their access. They act that way, and they may feel that way. But I would like them to reveal, actually, they don't have to do that. They do have a choice, and puts a responsibility on them. I kept my mouth closed hundreds of times. Did I feel at each point in the government, when I know that McNamara is lying, did I feel the need to go up to the cameras and say, "Wait a minute, my boss just told the exact opposite of what he said to you minutes ago. He's lying." Did I even think of doing that? It didn't occur to me that I had a choice. But actually, I did. Maybe not doing it quite that dramatically, but I've had other occasions. I could have taken a newsman aside, said, "Look, here's what McNamara said to me actually 10 minutes ago. I didn't do that. I didn't feel, in other words, I was able to be a government official. If the president wants to lie, if his secretary of defense wants to lie, you know, I'm there to help him do what he wants to do. What could be better than that? When I realized that you could do better than doing what the president wants to do, because the president was killing many people, was committing mass murder, as we're doing right now in Yemen, and as Bolton wants to do in North Korea and Iran, I would say that the time right now is to start a movement that there must not be war against Iran. And rather than waiting until the war has started and then trying to stop it, which may succeed after 10 years or so or not, we should be protesting right now and saying this absolutely would be aggression. We will not accept it. And how will we stop it? Well, general civil disobedience of various kinds, it would be suitable. And to stop a war with Iran, a general strike would be good to do it. Will that happen? Almost certainly not. No, very, very unlikely that that would happen. And by the way, the close companion of Trump, Lindsey Graham, who had opposed him earlier when in the primaries, but is now his close buddy, he said, if we have to go to war, and he said, I know the president agrees with this, President Trump, I've heard him say it. He said, you have to realize that there will be a lot of casualties, but the casualties will be all over there. That's the way he said it, by the way, on television. They'll be over there. They won't be Americans. Now, that's Nixon. You know, you're so concerned about civilians, I just don't give a damn. And Kissinger doesn't want him to look like a butcher. But Lindsey Graham is saying to the public now on television, we'll only be killing other people, and our allies will go, as Bolton just said. Japanese, the South Koreans will go. That's your business. You know, you're the military person. I'm just saying this has to be done. They don't care. They should care. They should take that into account. You should consider doing what I wish I had done in 1964. There's a poster of me saying, don't do what I did. I wrote this. Don't wait until a new war has started. Don't wait until thousands more have died before you tell the truth with documents that reveal lies or crimes or internal projections of costs and dangers. You might save a war's worth of lives. Well, I've said something to that effect many times, but consider doing, and I don't tell people they must do this or they have no choice but to do this, or that, you know, you have no choice. You've got to do this. You've got to sacrifice your career. I don't tell individuals that. And they generally don't feel that they don't have any choice, but they take a different choice eventually, some of them, like Chelsea Manning and Ed Snowden, from the choices they made earlier. Snowden kept a lot of secrets. Chelsea Manning kept a lot of secrets until they didn't and told the truth. And they didn't do it because they had no choice, but they did it because they took a different choice, and it was patriotic. It was better for the country. You know, right now, somebody who's come out well in the Mueller report is McGahn, isn't that his name? The president's counsel, who kept him from doing clearly impeachable things, namely to fire the special prosecutor, as Nixon did. Nixon did fire the prosecutor, and that made him impeachable. So McGahn says his advice is, don't do this. You can't do this. The president wanted him to fire the special prosecutor, Mueller. I will resign. I will not do this. He said, I don't want to be part of another Nixon saga. So McGahn is getting credit for this. And it occurred to me, was McGahn being loyal or disloyal when he told the president, you can't do this and I won't do it, I will resign first? Was not McGahn keeping him from impeachment? Everybody's saying that is the key point here. So not only McGahn, but Madison, others were ignoring what the president said. In Trump's book, that's disloyal. He fired many people for that, you know, that kind of thing. Give endless examples. Were they being disloyal to him by, as we now know, preventing him from being prosecuted and put in prison for doing this stuff? I would say that was a kind of loyalty. Trump wouldn't say that. And what I'm saying is that all of these whistleblowers were being loyal to their country in a way that none of their associates were doing. The rest of us, when I was obeying the president and keeping my mouth shut, were violating our oath of office, which was to support and defend the Constitution, when I, in particular, knew that the president was lying to Congress, Johnson, about getting us into a war on false pretenses. When we go to war in Iran with Bolton's pressure, it will almost surely be accompanied by false pretenses of they attacked this, they did this or that, something or other, and many people will know that. Will any of them talk? No one did before Iraq, although there must have been thousands of people in CIA and White House and Pentagon who not only knew that we were going toward war with Iraq, but that it was an aggressive, illegal, criminal war, and that it would kill between 1 and 2 million civilians. Not one leaked beforehand. But one person in England, Catherine Gunn, did leak a more than top secret document that showed where they were going and faced trial for it. There's a movie about her just now called Official Secrets. But one person in England, no person in America did that, did what Snowden and Chelsea did later. See, after this, they both signed up and served during the Iraq period, and then later saw better, just as I did. So talk about the past illuminating the future and the present. Yes, as Santayana said very famously, those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. The lesson is, when you find out that the president is on an absolutely in-on track that is going to murder thousands to millions of people, and if it's a nuclear war with North Korea, we're definitely talking millions. With Russia, it would be billions, meaning most people on Earth. If you see that coming, of course it's worth giving your life or death. As Chelsea Manning put it, she was ready to face capital punishment for this. And when I read that, I thought, that's the way I thought. I haven't heard anybody say that for 39 years. So I identify more with Chelsea and Ed Snowden, who said, there are things worth dying for. And he's in permanent exile in many places in the world. He's in Russia with exile at this point. Other places he'd be definitely in danger of death. I have no doubt of that, just as I was on May 3rd, 1972. So, of course, it's worth that. And it's not that you have no choice. You're human. You're able to make that choice better than you did in the past. I wish I had done in 64 what I did do in 69 and 71. It might have prevented the war. And that's a heavy responsibility.
I'm so inspired by Dr. Ellsberg's words. I feel like a student sitting at the feet of a master. And now, I must use this knowledge to stand up, as he says, and get in the way of the machine. In our vast network of educators, I know of no teacher who is as committed to defending truth as our beloved freedom writer teacher, Dr. Tom Reifer. Tom is an award-winning professor of sociology at the University of San Diego, and an associate fellow at the Transnational Institute based in Amsterdam. Tom was also the one who introduced us to his dear friend and mentor, Dr. Dan Ellsberg. As we conclude this episode, I want to share with you part of Tom's story about how he met Dan when he was a mere teenager. He also reflects on what teachers, parents, and students can do in their everyday lives to seek truth and promote democracy.
Well, it's a strange tale. I've been born in Spanish Harlem to heroin-addicted parents and then taken to Orange County, and I ran away from domestic violence when I was 13, and I met my sister a year later, who was working for the nuclear weapons freeze started by Randy Forsberg, who I later met. And being involved in that movement, I found out that Daniel Ellsberg was going to teach this course at University of California, Irvine. So 35 years ago, I was in this course, 16 years old, 400 people, and Dan asked these two questions, and I happened to know the answer, and that was the first time we met. I got invited because of that to join the graduate seminar. I did manage to pass the high school proficiency test, and Dan wrote me a letter to get into college. Later on, I became his research assistant, and it changed my life. We stayed friends for 35 years. I was fortunate enough to help him write Secrets and his last book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. And it's a little bit ironic because despite having never taken the SAT, I eventually ended up getting a BA, an MA, and a PhD in sociology. And now I'm a full professor at the University of San Diego. So I got an incredible education working especially with Dan because Dan represented to me something that I felt was sorely lacking when I was a child, adults who told the truth and took a stand against what was wrong. I wasn't very impressed with adults when I was a kid. So I think that when I met Dan, he really represented somebody to me who would take a stand, and that's the same way I felt about Ms. G and the Freedom Riders. When the Freedom Riders first came out, I really identified it because I felt I was one of those kids and got the chance to meet Maria. Then, when I went to the Freedom Riders teacher's training, I had this epiphany, and I went to Miss G and I said, I just realized this difference between me and all the 150 Freedom Riders. And she said, what's that? I said, well, unlike the Freedom Riders, I'm the only person that never graduated from high school because I didn't have a Miss G. And Erin turned at me and she said, well, you do now. But I realized that the truth of it is that before I met Erin, Dan was my Miss G. Seeing Erin and Dan together, it was a little bit of an out-of-body experience because these are my two greatest teachers and two of my favorite people in the world. And really, I see them as engaged in a very similar enterprise, trying to educate people, especially young people, and give them hope for the world by imbuing them with a sense of purpose of what we can do together. So I think as Lata said in the introduction of the Freedom Riders Diary, we make history every day. We're active participants. We're not just watching something going on. And I think the most important thing that Dan and Erin talked about is the power of making moral choices, the power of what we can do every day, every second to make the world a better place. I think everybody can do what they can to educate themselves and be involved in their communities. We live at a time where hate is rampant, and oftentimes it comes about because the flames are fanned by political figures, and we can educate ourselves about the lessons of history, and that's about the dangers of when good people do nothing. And so I think that education in the context of relationships and trying to make the world a better place is something that everybody can do, and that's why it's so important that we have education available for everybody in the world. I guess without Erin and the Freedom Riders and Maria and all the characters, we wouldn't have this amazing story of hope. Without Dan Ellsberg listening to the people suffering from the war and going to jail to resist it, we wouldn't have the Pentagon Papers, which helped bring down the Nixon administration. So the thing is, we have these stories which show what people can do. The stories didn't have to exist. They came to exist because people did things and worked together and made a difference. And we just have to take that same spirit of hope, the spirit that Anne Frank projected. And that's why her story has meaning, because it's a message in a bottle and we can take it up and live it every day. At the end of the interview, we didn't record it. Dan was talking about the work that Erin did with the Freedom Riders. It's the same thing that he's doing, teaching them about history, teaching them about education, but not education based upon standardized tests, but education in the context of a relationship, education in the context of making the world a better place. And that's the only kind of education that matters. That's the only kind of education that's important for our world.
That concludes our show this week. I'm so grateful to Dr. Daniel Ellsberg and Dr. Tom Reifer for sharing their stories and insights with us. As our guest so eloquently stated, may we oppose and expose corruption. May we be willing to sacrifice for the good of all. And may we work together to create a more peaceful and more just world for future generations. If you'd like to support the podcast, please leave us a review and share it with someone that you think will also benefit from our meaningful messages and thought-provoking guests. We're grateful to have you as part of our Freedom Rider family and look forward to staying connected with you. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Cyrier and Rob Falk, with historical consultation by Dr. Tom Reifer. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.